Professor Lear's topic this afternoon is gratitude and meaning. Please join me in welcoming Professor Lear.
When I was an undergraduate, with only a vague thought that it might be a good idea, I took a course on Chinese history. The professor was young, and he spoke with an English accent, and that impressed us all. Now, looking back, I realized that I was taken less with the content of the course than with the joy that he took in teaching it. His absorption in the material and the vigor and imagination with which he told his stories, that really grabbed me. And at midterm, he made an announcement that if anyone received an A for the course, they would have the opportunity to write another paper and for no credit whatsoever. Call this his English eccentricity. There was something comic about an award whose prize is more work and no credit. I was hooked. I mention this moment because it happened to me at about, you know, your stage in life, you who were the undergraduates in this room. But it ended up having a lifelong significance. I could not have known that at the time. In effect, the teacher taught me, was one of the people who helped to teach me, the joy of learning for its own sake. He taught me how to be a student, and later in life I realized that he was also teaching me how to be a teacher. I assumed that I thanked him at the time, but how could any thank you then be adequate to a lifetime gift? I could not have understood what I was thanking him for, but there is something about the nature of that gift that makes that mismatch all right. And what is that? Let's see if I can do this. So the question I want to explore in this lecture is, what role does gratitude play in a flourishing human life? I'm concerned with what Aristotle called a happy life. And happiness, or as he called it, eudaimonia, qualifies not this moment or that moment, but a whole life, in the sense of bios is what he would use. And in contemporary English, we use phrases like a full life, a rich, meaningful life, a life well lived. What is the place of gratitude in life taken as a whole? So I am asking about the goodness of gratitude for the value of one's life. I'm not asking right now about the rightness of a grateful response in appropriate circumstances. Now, there are two reasons why this question has tended to be overlooked. First, from the religious perspective of the Abrahamic religions, gratitude to God is overwhelmingly called for. God created the world, made it good, and entered into personal relationships with human beings. The question I am asking focuses on the relationship of human beings with each other, and it's certainly intelligible in this larger context, but it tends to linger in the shadow of the brilliant, commanding question of our proper relation to God. But second, if one takes a secular point of view, the place of gratitude in a flourishing life is Aristotelian in spirit, but Aristotle himself did not hold gratitude in high esteem. It's good in appropriate circumstances to thank people, but from Aristotle's point of view, life would be so much better if one could be a benefactor rather than a recipient. Now, Aristotle's own outlook seems to me a relic of an aristocratic outlook that I think we would be better off without. So I want to approach the question in a broadly Aristotelian spirit, and what I think of as a broadly Aristotelian approach to ethics, but correct for his more aristocratic values. I mean, basically, I'm interested in whether Aristotelian ethics can be made vibrant in a democratic time and culture. Gratitude, I want to argue, is a mode of our flourishing that calls into question Aristotle's conceptualization and valorization of self-sufficiency. Gratitude is a celebration of our dependency, and in favorable circumstances, there are certain modes of acknowledging and welcoming our dependence that constitutes our flourishing. So the case I want to make is compatible with either a secular outlook or a religious outlook, and the overall thesis is this. The first is that gratitude is fundamental to the human condition in that it is a condition of our flourishing or happiness in the sense of eudaimonia. Second, in those conditions of happiness, gratitude will manifest itself as constitutive of our rational lives. And thus, finally, gratitude will constitute the very, in this sense outlined above, gratitude will constitute the very being of our human being, namely as an animal having logos, or a rational animal. I'll get to the rationality later. Okay. I'll just say in passing that this whole talk was contingently triggered for me. I happened to read a paper by a very distinguished psychoanalyst named Melanie Klein, who at the end of her career wrote a paper where she sort of summed everything up about what she had learned in a paper called Envy and Gratitude. And so I was puzzled by the fact that she placed gratitude at the apex of human flourishing. Why didn't she put happiness or self-satisfaction or, you know, self-acceptance? You know, why gratitude? And why did she place envy as its evil twin? Why did she pair envy and gratitude? I'll just mention that in passing. That's how I got started. That's what triggered me. So let me talk about the social meaning of the emotions and a particular puzzle about gratitude. For Aristotle, gratitude is an emotion. He called it a pathos. And in paradigm cases, emotions make a claim to their own rational legitimacy, and they play an intermediate function in restoring order and well-being. So, for example, this is Aristotle on anger. Anger, he says, may be defined as a desire accompanied by pain for a conspicuous revenge, for a conspicuous slight at the hands of men who have no call to slight oneself or one's friends. And it must always be attended by a certain pleasure, or which arises from an expectation of revenge. And so anger plays a kind of intermediate role in the social world. And here I just want to say I've been helped very much by a book by David Constant called The Emotions of the Ancient Greeks. But here you can see the idea of anger as having an intermediate role. There's a prior event, which I'm insulted or I'm injured, and my emotion arises, anger, and I'm motivated to a response, which is some kind of revenge or punishment. And the hoped for outcome is that, you know, in some broad sense, justice will be restored. That's Aristotle's thought of the of how, roughly speaking, how emotions work. And here he is on fear. Fear is defined as a pain or a disturbance to imagining some destructive or painful evil in the future. It's caused by whatever we feel has power of destroying us or harming us, and that way it causes great pain, and hence the very indications of such thing are terrible, and they make us feel that the thing, terrible thing, is itself close at hand. So here's another just sort of thumbnail sketch of the emotions for Aristotle. You've got this prior event, which is the threat. An emotion is triggered, which is fear. It's this intermediate place. The response is you get away, somehow get away, and the hope for outcome is that safety is restored. So that's the basic idea of how, for Aristotle, that's the shortest introduction to Aristotle's emotions. So, of course, with emotions, there's plenty of room for misfires. People can imagine insults or threats that do not exist. They exaggerate some things and they ignore others. Emotional irrationality is common, but that fact, the fact of emotional irrationality, should not obscure Aristotle's central point that for a person well attuned to the world and whose character is well formed, namely a virtuous person, their emotional life will be constitutive of their flourishing. When things are going well, emotions contribute to our happiness as they partially constitute our rational living. In the cases we've just been considering, anger and fear, they're part of our efforts to restore justice or safety. Okay, but how about gratitude? And it turns out that's really not at all an easy question to answer. And I'll start with Aristotle's definition, which is kind of tricky to get the hang of it, because he defines the emotion of gratitude in terms of defining a favor. And I'll just say the word favor here is being used in a special sense. Aristotle's trying not just any old favor. This is the sense of favor. So he says, let a favor, and the Greek is charis, let a favor in the sense in which a person has received it is said to be grateful, be a service provided to one in need, not in return for anything, nor in order that the provider gets something, but in order that the recipient gets something. So as I said, you know, the words gratitude and favor can be used in all sorts of ways, but Aristotle is focusing in on special uses for that those terms. And gratitude in Aristotle's sense is the appropriate response to a favor, and the favor has these three important hallmarks. A favor in the special sense, the person is responding to a perceived need, it's for the sake of the recipient, and there's no expectation of return. So gratitude, which is the response to the favor, is an expression of thanks that comes along with an understanding of what it is thankful for. So if I responded to a favor, in that special sense of favor, if I responded to a favor with thanks, but also with an intense sense of obligation that I better repay that debt, I would have misunderstood what I had just been given. Part of understanding is understanding I've been given something with no strings attached, and the gratitude expresses that understanding. With a favor, there is, in some important sense, no debt to be repaid. So gratitude, like other emotions, does fit into the social network, but it is very unclear how. If there's no debt, what do you do next? Now, it's important to recognize that this favor-gratitude dynamic that I've been talking about doesn't fit in with what might ordinary call the ordinary economy of favors and reciprocation. This is the ordinary economy. It's my birthday, and I'm hoping my friends will throw me a surprise party. That's the prior need. And guess what? I happen to have a good friend. And, you know, she throws me a surprise party that I, you know, that's what I needed. She gave it to me. My emotion is gratitude. I'll put it in quotes. You know, I'm grateful that she gave me the party. But, you know, I sort of feel I'd better remember her birthday next year. It's sort of my job, you know, maybe not in a party, but something, you know, birthday card, take her out to dinner or something. There's some kind of an economy here. It's all very nice. I don't want to make it sound cynical, but I want to make it sound, make it realize that there's an economy here that may be implicit. And what you get is sort of social harmony and, you know, kind of equality of relationship. And similarly, you know, I may have a prior need, not just hunger, but for sociality. And some of my colleagues invite me to their home for dinner. I'm grateful to be invited to dinner. What do? I bring a bottle of wine, or I invite them back in the fullness of time. I invite them back to dinner. Again, you get social harmony. It's constitutive of this ordinary economy, the favors and gifts, that they're given in the expectation, implicit or explicit, with some kind of reciprocation. And now this is a caricatured version, because I do think this is a very sincere and important part of our lives. But the caricature, which makes a point, is, you know, think of the Godfather. If he does you a favor, everyone knows that at some point he will expect you to express your gratitude by doing something for him in return. As I said, it's a caricature, and the ordinary economy does not have to be that cynical. The favor may be experienced as generous, the gratitude may be sincere and heartfelt, but nevertheless, it's understood that in the fullness of time, some kind of reciprocation is due. There is much to be said in favor of this form of sociality. There are people, for instance, you know, I can speak about colleagues and neighbors with whom, you know, I'd like to maintain genuinely cordial relations, but, you know, I don't want to get any closer to them than I am now, nor do I feel like being on the receiving end of a genuine favor, and that in the sense that Aristotle, I don't particularly want to know strings attached. I like getting along the way we are. So the person who is, you know, you go out for dinner occasionally, and sometimes you pay the bill, other times they pay the bill. The person who's taken out says thank you, and the one who pays the bill to the one who pays the bill, and the person who says thank you really means it. But that's not the favor-gratitude dynamic that Aristotle just isolated. The Aristotelian dynamic transcends that ordinary economy, yet it remains immanent within sociality itself. It is a different manner of relating to each other. It's a difference that makes a difference to opening up possibilities for us living together. And it's this different manner of being with each other that makes gratitude, as I'm trying to describe it, so important. And in a similar way, the gratitude dynamic transcends, you might say, the ordinary, what I'll call the ordinary service economy of payment in response to professional services. So I have a cavity, I get dental repair, I pay the dentist, and I get dental health. You know, my car breaks down, I go to the mechanic, I pay them, I get a well-running car. You know, similarly with plumbing, the idea is the payment does the trick. We're done. We don't have, you know. Now, one might form a personal and friendly relationship with a person who is providing a service. I mean, as it turns out, I'm friendly with my dentist. He's the dentist of the Chicago Blackhawks. He's the dentist to all the really good hockey players. I think it's impressive. And so I get to talk to him about it. It's fun. But, you know, in the ordinary service economy, that's maybe nice, but it's not necessary. And on occasion, there's a team of doctors or a team of mechanics. One never gets to know the person providing the service. Payment is supposed to be payment in full. Now, a range of emotions might arise in these circumstances, or none at all. The ordinary service economy is excellent when all you want is expert service and would prefer to abstain from personal relations of any complexity. And there are occasions when I don't want to know the person better, though I do want them to be well paid for their service. So the service economy is the structure in which occasions for gratitude, as Aristotle understood them, do not arise. Gratitude takes itself to be an appropriate response to a favor. It recognizes the favor for what it is, namely no strings attached, and accepts it gratefully. And when circumstances permit, a thank you to the benefactor is a manifestation of the gratitude itself. But how could merely putting the gratitude into words be enough? By contrast with anger, it's usually not the case to say that saying I am angry with you is enough. Angry people tend to want revenge, or at least some kind of satisfaction or restitution. Indeed, often when we put our anger into words, it's an attempt to diminish it. And that is one reason why talking cures are meant to be therapeutic. When I get to say I'm angry at you, we're on the business of, you know, getting over the anger. But then, what is the larger social context for gratitude? We've already seen that the favor-gratitude dynamic floats free of the ordinary exchanges of reciprocation. Now, the verbal expression of gratitude has some form of completeness to it, in that it recognizes that no further reciprocation is called for. But this can't be the end of the story. But then, what forms of sociality does gratitude facilitate? So, you know, there are various things I've put there. You know, I might be hungry, I might need shelter, I might need care, I might need some sense of meaningfulness or being understood. And the favor of the Aristotelian favor is it grants that problem, it sort of solves that problem, and there's no strings attached. And my emotion is gratitude, but where does it go from there? I mean, if we were trying to fill out that picture, that's my question. Excuse me. So from an Aristotelian perspective, if gratitude is constitutive of a flourishing life, it ought to be clear how it promotes well-being, both individually and in a larger social context. And this is our problem. On the one hand, there seems to be a certain completeness in the expression of gratitude in response to a favor. On the other hand, there is an incompleteness that still needs to be accounted for. And so now I'm going to talk about the debt of gratitude. I put debt in quotes. Sorry, I made a mess. This phrase is ironic and earnest at the same time, this debt of gratitude. It would be a misfire if the gratitude did not acknowledge the favor as for the recipient's own sake and with no expectation of return. Yet, it's incredible that this should be the end of the story. We find the idea of a debt of gratitude compelling, however little we may understand it. And I think we can take a hint from Aristotle's Greek. This is going to be a very brief Greek lesson. So this is, you know, what is a debt of gratitude for if it's for the recipient's own sake? But this shouldn't be the end of the story. And here's something interesting about the Greek, which is the word for favor and the word for gratitude have a repetition in it. The gratitude literally means, if it means karineke, the N at the end is just the case of charis, it means have a favor. That's what being grateful is literally means in Greek. The favor, in some sense, is taken over, appropriated. It's now something the recipient has. And I think that there's a, you know, in the giving of the favor, the being of grateful is now I've got the favor. And I think this is a very fruitful ambiguity, for having the favor means gratitude, but on the other hand, a favor is precisely what the benefactor has. He had the favor to give. It's what the benefactor bestowed. And if we take a step back and we think about benefactors and we ask, why? Why did they give their benefactions? It is not unusual to discover it was because they themselves experienced themselves as filled with gratitude. You know, that's that same kind of expression of fullness. That is, they were filled with having favors, favors to give. Now, the Greek word for charis and the expression of, for favor and the expression for gratitude, charin ekein, derive from a common Greek verb, kairo, which means to be glad or to rejoice or take delight in or take pleasure. And the giving of the favor delights the benefactor, the giving delights the benefactor, and the receiving of the favor delights the recipient. And I think in an Aristotelian, one might think of there being this kind of one unified activity of giving and receiving. The activity may stretch out over space and time, but it breaks down if it loses these two complementary aspects. So there's a kind of unified activity of delighting and taking pleasure in, and there's the pleasure of giving and the pleasure of gratitude in receiving, but it forms a kind of unified activity of giving and receiving. Now, the delights of generosity, the sense of having enough to share, of doing a good deed, of satisfaction in giving, they differ from the delights of receiving a favor that fits one's real needs and for one's own sake. But there is a common delight in which both can participate, delight in participating in an activity that transcends the ordinary economies of sociality. Donor and recipient experience firsthand and delight in a special human way of being together, something freed of what we are now experienced as mere confines, the confines of mere sociality. We experience something for which we might not have a good vocabulary, but this is where I think the language of higher and finer starts to feel like you need to use it. So let me give an example with which some of us have had experience. Donors and recipients of scholarships and fellowships at colleges and universities. Now, of course, there are many kinds of donors. I want to focus in on just one paradigm. And the paradigm I want to focus on are students who had, or they were former students, they were students who had such an extraordinary experience as undergraduates who do well enough financially, and later in life they're filled with gratitude. They express their gratitude by funding scholarships for future generations of students. Now, it's possible to be on the receiving end of such a fellowship and not give a second thought about how it came to be. But what would it be to receive it gratefully? Obviously, if explicit thanks were possible, that might be appropriate. Some donors appreciate being recognized and appreciated for what they've done, but not all. Some want to remain anonymous. And others give in the expectation that their gifts will go to people they will never meet, and perhaps long after they're dead. The true expression of gratitude is, I think, marked by a double understanding. First, that there's no obligation to reciprocate. But second, that in being given a benefit for one's own sake, one takes responsibility for making good use of it as such. And I think that is the so-called debt of gratitude. It is taken to be repayment, to make good use of the benefit. But recipients of the benefit have the freedom to determine as best they can what good use consists in. They do so gratefully. In effect, the favor-gratitude dynamic opens the possibility for a new kind of responsibility. In the ordinary economy of gift and reciprocation, in accepting a gift, I take on responsibility for return. But in gratitude, I acknowledge a different kind of responsibility to make the best use of it by my own lights in the manner in which to demonstrate and the manner in which to demonstrate my thanks. What is given to the students is an opportunity for what I think of as creative repetition. not to follow this or that particular path, but to repeat in the sense of making good use of one's benefit by one's own light of what that means. And to do so gratefully, that is, you know, as we put it, filled with the favor, having the favor. That gratitude, having the favor, inclines one to being filled with favor towards a kind of generosity oneself. So we might fill out the Aristotelian structure of gratitude in this way. You know, you've got the hunger or the, you know, the need for meaning. You get the fulfillment in with no, you know, some granting of solving or satisfying of the need with no strings attached. There's the sense of gratitude, and there's a kind of creative repetition, becoming one's best self, thankfully, according to one's own understanding of what that means. And hope the hope for outcome is eudaimonia, freedom to be yourself and do that well. And once you sort of see that kind of molecule, you can see that there, it's possible that there's a larger structure that opens out indefinitely. You know, there's the prior need, the favor is the response, the gratitude, repetition. You become a benefactor, you satisfy a prior need for somebody else, and there you go. I mean, it's not a great chart, but I'm not very good at this kind of thing, but I hope you get the idea. In each case, in experiencing gratitude, one feels the call to express thanks for being, for being or becoming someone who can make something good out of a favor. And I think, you know, in psychoanalysis, I don't know if any of you are interested in this, I'll just say in passing, there's a very helpful distinction between what is called a superego and an ego ideal. The voice of the superego is a kind of demand of obligation, and it can be quite punishing. It can make one feel guilty or ashamed for not living up to a demand. The call of an ego ideal, by contrast, is more gentle and enticing. To live up to one's own ideals of what one would like to be, thinks it's worth being. And gratitude, I think, fortifies the ego ideal for support. It becomes support for living up to one's own ideals. And now I want to talk about gratitude and nutrition. So it seems that when things are going well, gratitude is an activity of a metabolizing goodness. It bears an analogy with what Aristotle called the nutritive soul. Now, in our hunger, we take in some part of the external world, food, and through digestion, we turn it into ourselves. You know, when I have a hamburger, some part of it becomes me. That's what the nutritive soul does. It's amazing. With gratitude, there is a level of conscious understanding and acceptance, but it retains the basic structure of the nutritive soul. We have this antecedent need, a kind of hunger, that the benefactor satisfied with the favor, which comes as food or nourishment, and in gratitude, recipients metabolize that favor into themselves. This cycle, I think, is a form of nourishment, and I think it's more than an analogy. The link between nutrition and gratitude is embedded deep, I think, in the human psyche. And here's a little bit more psychoanalytic thinking, or but I think it'll be intuitive to you. Let me know later. So the humans are born helpless. So the first feedings are in an intergenerational transformation of food. In an idealized, the first feedings are an intergenerational transmission of food. In an idealized scene, a loving and intuitive mother takes her baby in her arms. The baby is just at the edge of hunger, feeling the need arrive, and the mother lovingly and calmly takes the infant to her breast, gives the baby a good feed. And again, I'm using mother as a, you know, widespread term. We're talking about loving feeding. The milk is coming in, you know, from inside the mother, from the baby's experience. It's coming lovingly and for the baby's sake. And from a psychoanalytic view, this is a fertile occasion for imaginative activity. This is the thought. For the baby, the mother's goodness is embodied in her milk. And the baby now feels that it, the baby, has her mother's goodness inside of itself. It is a bodily sensation embellished by fantasy, a fantasy of feeding on good, taking it inside and transforming it into oneself, feeling full of something good or decent. The taking it in is called internalization in psychoanalysis, and transforming it into oneself, a sense of self, is called identification. Now, when things are going well, the infant experiences an infantile form of gratitude. There is an inchoate sense that the mothering world is full of goodness and beneficence. There is enough loving goodness to give the infant without threat of the mother losing her own goodness. She remains a constant loving mother even after the feed. The infant takes the goodness in willingly and in fantasy makes it part of him or herself. And this is a primordial creative repetition, and future repetitions are thought to be based on this, you know, from a psychoanalytic point of view. So when things are going well, infantile gratitude is a psychic achievement. There are challenges to be overcome. First, there is there's a lure of omnipotence. Let's see if I've got this. No, I won't do that yet. First, there's a kind of lure of omnipotence, that discriminating fantasy from reality is a developmental task. We don't just do it automatically. And if we're hungry and food arrives at the time of wishfully imagining it, it can seem as though we've done it on our own. And there is a tendency in the human soul to take ourselves to be the source of our own well-being. Gratitude, by contrast, thankfully acknowledges dependence. It is, welcomes a source of goodness as coming outside itself. And second, there is in the human soul a tendency towards envy. Envy is a nauseated outrage at any source of goodness. I can't go into complexities of envy now, but in brief, envy stimulates a rage-filled attack on any source of goodness and tries to do away with it. And it's a kind of negative omnipotence and insistence on despair. And Coleridge called it motiveless malignity. The envious person is not pursuing some evil because he mistakenly thinks it's good. He's against goodness. And that is what makes envy so difficult to understand. The standard form of belief, desire, psychological explanation does not seem to apply. And in this sense, envy resists understanding. It's a will to non-being. And I think now you can see why Melanie Clyde singled out envy and gratitude as two poles on this axis of human existence. Envy's route is to attack, you know, they're each fundamental ways of metabolizing the world's goodness. One is to attack it and destroy it and reduce it to nothingness. And gratitude's route is to accept it thankfully and make it into oneself, acknowledging a special blend of dependence and independence. On the one hand, it is mother's milk, I've taken it in, but in identifying with it, I transform it into a sense of my own goodness, my own self-confidence. This is a nutritive process of gratitude. In gratitude, I develop confidence that I have enough goodness so that I too can give it away to others without losing it. When things are going well, this is constitutive of my flourishing. So I want to talk about intergenerational transmission. Moving to the adult world, a significant amount of philanthropy is intergenerational, an older generation bequeathing goods to a future generation. And I think there's something similar to the structure of the original feeding situation that I just outlined, but it's recreated at an adult level. Let us consider one salient difference, and that is taking death into account. Our own and those around us. It's something that humans do. And I mean this as a kind of natural historical generalization in the sense that Michael Thompson has been making clear in his work. Not that all of us do it, but that taking death into account characterizes us as human. Now, if there is such a thing as a distinctively human mode of flourishing, eudaimon, there be ways to take death into account in living a happy life. It can't be the thing that destroys happiness to be taking it into account, if there is such a thing. It's also characteristic of us that the issue of death is more on our minds in middle age and later age. It's part of our human developmental trajectory. But how does one live well with the prospect of one's own death? It seems to depend on finding a good balance between preserving, nurturing, and letting go. On the one hand, we find comfort in thinking that the projects and ideals that have mattered to us will continue on in what Samuel Scheffler has called the afterlife. On the other hand, if one ties one's wishes too closely to being remembered personally or for a very specific project being carried out successfully, one may succeed in the short run, but it's likely that this persisting good will have its own finite limit. And here I am struck by how many buildings there are on college campuses named after people who nobody remembers who they are. That was certainly the case on my campus. So my hunch is that one route to leading a happy human life and taking one's mortality into account is to turn oneself into a benefactor, that is, one who is capable of bestowing a favor. The favor need not be material goods. There are all sorts of ways to support others' needs. The important point is this. Turning oneself into a benefactor requires both trust and hope. A favor is for the sake of the recipient with no expectation of return. It's up to recipients to make their own best use of that good that they have received. This is inevitably a process of transformation, one which is not up to the benefactor and which may lie beyond what the benefactor can even imagine. When the benefaction succeeds over a long duration of time, it's more likely that this will be so. So on the side of the recipient, gratitude builds confidence by metabolizing confidence. It's internal to the act of bestowing a favor that the benefactor has confidence in the recipient and that the recipient can make good use of receiving a benefit with no strings attached. In gratitude, the recipient acknowledges that there's a special trust imminent in the very activity of this kind of giving and accepts it with a developing sense of confidence. Now I want to talk about gratitude and integration. So summing up, we can see that gratitude promotes integration at three levels. First, there is psychic integration in the individual between the rational and the non-rational parts of the soul. The early infantile fantasies of gratitude persist and link to the more well-defined activities of generosity and gratitude in adulthood. An elemental pattern is set for accepting, acknowledging, and transforming the good. And at the same time, a basic confidence in one's own goodness is established that lends vitality to life in adulthood. Second, there's an integration in one's sense of a life well lived. Memories and beneficent influences of others recur in life. And one comes to see those moments as shaping one's life. And in that very process, one integrates one's life. The sense of inheriting these gifts, of making good use of them, lends a sense of meaningfulness to one's own life. And third, there is an integration of the generations. The goods of one generation passed on to the next, for them to make good use of them by their own lights, and ties together human history in the attempts to metabolize goodness over time. And looking back, gratitude acknowledges the gift of coming from the past. Now I want to talk about the rationality of gratitude and the irrationality of gratitude. We're moving on to reason now. So Aristotle investigated the emotions in the Rhetoric, not a textbook on psychology. And this was because he was concerned with the power of public speech to stir up our emotions, which can in turn distort our reasoning. As he says here at the beginning of the Rhetoric, things do not appear the same to those who love and those who hate, nor to those who are angry or to those who are mild-mannered. To the one who loves, the person about whom he makes his judgment seems not to do injustice or to do little injustice, but those who hate it, for those who hate, it's the contrary. That's why it's important not to stir up our emotions, especially when we are trying to come to some kind of responsible judgment. And as he says here, that basically this would be as if someone who were going to use a straight edge made it crooked. The word for straight edge is, there it is in Greek, but it's, you know, sometimes it's translated as ruler, but basically it's the kind of measuring where you need a straight line, okay? I'm going to explain how this all works sort of right now, but I just wanted you to see those Aristotle quotes that, you know, these are important. So how does this kind of thing happen with gratitude? How are things look with gratitude? How do you reason with gratitude? What would it be for a straight edge to be genuinely straight or to be crooked? So I have been sketching out the goodness of gratitude for life as a whole when things are going well. But that doesn't mean that gratitude is always good. Gratitude, like any other emotion, can be elicited in false and distorting ways. So imagine we are citizens who watch certain news channels and read certain newspapers and participate in certain social media. And imagine we read an op-ed page that basically the argument of which has this basic structure. I'll call this a gratitude syllogism. Here's a premise. He's making our country great again. He's reinvigorating our best ideals. He understands and supports us. He gives us power to alter the events of our time. It's done for our sake. This isn't just about paying him back. Therefore, we should join in to make the country great again. We'll be living up to our own ideals. Now, I call this a syllogism in Aristotle's broad sense of putting something forward in public space by people who claim it ought to claim our rational assent. It is meant to persuade us through its reasoning, which we ought to be able to recognize the reasoning as such. It need not be formally valid, like Aristotle's formal syllogisms. It only claims to command rational assent via our understanding and assenting to the content of what is being asserted. The premises are meant to be plainly true, and the conclusion is meant to follow clearly from the premises. Of course, the premises may not be true, the argument may not be valid or sound, but this is the type of argument that is put forward in public space with the claim that it is true and ought to command assent. And here I'm not concerned with like the inner psychological states of those who put these arguments forward. Perhaps they're cynical, perhaps they're motivated by resentment, perhaps they're sincere and heartfelt. Rather, I'm concerned with the emotion that structures people's outlook in such a way that that should they go through the argument, they would find it persuasive. And the relevant emotion that I'm trying to be interested in now is, of course, gratitude. So now suppose over on another news channel, or another newspaper, there's a different op-ed responding to the same public events that has this form. I'll call this the angry syllogism. That bum is a charlatan. He makes everything that happens about himself. He understands people only to take advantage of them. He misleads people into thinking that they are doing good. He's doing everything for his sake. His power is dangerous. He will destroy the country. Therefore, let's get rid of him. I want to consider this. The important thing I want to do is to consider the place of emotions in both of these pieces of reasoning. Our gratitude towards some leader might be well placed or it might be misplaced. Suppose for now it's misplaced. Suppose I have misplaced gratitude. Now, Aristotle's point about the crooked, I'm going to focus on the gratitude because that's what I'm focusing on. We do it about anger too. Aristotle's point about the crooked straight edge is that it's going to be applied right here in our reasoning. It's just going to be right, it's internal to our reasoning. And in this case, you know, in the misplaced case, it's going to be distorting it as such rather than interpreting it correctly. We, the grateful, misplaced grateful people, we think we're getting straight to the point. That's the straight part of it. We will be minded to see unfolding events under the aura of making our country great again. And anyone who disagrees, we will think, is missing the point. It is their judgment that's distorted. But if unbeknownst to us, we are suffering an excess of gratitude, it's our judgment that is bent out of shape. That's what he means by the straight edge, or the crooked, making a straight edge crooked. In this way, excessive gratitude distorts the content of our premises, how we've interpreted these various things we've seen, without our recognizing it. We tend to experience events under the aura of being granted a favor when in fact that is not so. Gratitude, and this is a really important, I think it's a really important point, it's a point that really interests me. Gratitude not only affects the content of how these premises are formulated, it also influences the form of our argument. It affects my sense of salience, my sense of how things hang together and of what follows from what. Suppose all the premises are true and I correctly recognize them as true, but suppose as it happens, I'm not grateful. I do not feel the call of gratitude in my case. I may think that he is doing all sorts of good things. I may well think of his efforts. I may even admire him. But for me, the non-grateful person, nothing follows from that. Nothing seems to follow from that. Perhaps I have other good things to do. It's gratitude that licenses that sense of legitimacy or compellingness of the argument. It's when I'm thinking gratefully that the conclusion seems to follow in a compelling way from the premises. Gratitude need not be a particular subjective feel. It shows up in my sense of the legitimacy of the inference. And there's no need for an additional premise. I am grateful. It doesn't have to be there. In fact, you know, it could be there. But anyways, that's another long story. But it's an interesting fact. Gratitude is already present in my activity of living, attempting to live a rational life, which is trying to think things through. And here's an example of thinking things through. So there's no Archimedean point from which one can tell just by looking at the gratitude syllogism whether it's properly persuasive or not. For that, one needs the judgment of a virtuous person. The virtuous person will be properly attuned to the genuine occasions to which gratitude would be an appropriate response. It is possible that there are worldly occasions that would provoke a virtuous person to formulate that very gratitude syllogism. Gratitude could be working on that virtuous person in the right sort of way to give a sense of propriety and salience in that person's reasoning. And again, gratitude then will be in the reasoning. Only in this case, the virtuous person will be operating with a true straight edge, not a distorted one. Now note that although the syllogism, this gratitude syllogism, may have some contemporary resonances, it's not intrinsically associated with any political outlook, other than the broad idea that the nation state is a historically relevant entity to which to realize political ideals. This syllogism could equally be a reaction to Donald Trump, which I would guess you've thought about, as it could to John F. Kennedy's call to ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. And also notice it's possible for both syllogisms to be misguided. They both could be misguided, but they can't both be sound at the same time about the same person and the same events, etc. So, in conclusion, the point of this paper is not that gratitude is in itself good for us. Alas, in a world that is filled with deceit and selfishness and thoughtlessness and cruelty and motiveless catastrophe, there are plenty of occasions in which gratitude would be silly, self-deceived, or even disastrous. And also, Aristotle is right that our happiness, our flourishing, depends on good fortune. However, when we are fortunate enough to have good fortune, it is characteristic of our kind, in our dependence, that a significant portion of our good fortune will consist of favors in that Aristotelian sense, given appropriately in response to our needs, for our own sakes, and with no expectation of return. And what I've tried to do today is to show how living gratefully as a manner of taking up and responding to such generosity can plausibly be seen as constitutive of our flourishing. Under these fortunate circumstances, gratitude can also be understood as constitutive of our rational activity. And this gives us reason for thinking that gratitude is more than one emotion among others. It earns a special place in understanding what is special about our peculiarly human form of flourishing. Thank you.